All right. Well, my name is Don C. for Coyas, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm just really honored to be here at this this gathering. I have nine children altogether, and out of those nine children, I have 20 grandchildren and one great grandchild. And none of my children no longer have any problems or issues with alcohol. And my 20 grandchildren, they're all sober. They don't do drugs. They don't do alcohol. They're just, they have not been raised that way. And so it's like Al-Anon says, it's a family disease. And I have a great gratitude to Al-Anon. My oldest son now is 54, and he still talks about his days in Alateen. So him and his brothers and sisters, they all were going to Alateen while I was living a very destructive life. And so I'll always be grateful to Al-Anon for for that that help. So it took a lot of work. Our family went to a lot of counseling. We went to a lot of ceremony. We went through a lot of professional help, and it was very hard. And there comes time in my recovery time. There's times that I get into problems with one of my kids or one of my daughters or whatever. And that's when I go to Al-Anon. Al-Anon has always been very, very helpful to me. It gives me sometimes a program I don't seem to grasp get in AA. And so there's something happens to me and in Al-Anon, and they don't let me talk about what I think my real problem is. They make me talk about me healing myself, not healing my kids or changing them. So they're very, very, very beneficial to me in doing so. And so what I was told when I came in here was to share my experience, strength, and hope, to share what that was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And probably the best way I can tell what happened was to tell you a story. The story I got from one of my first sponsors, his name was Don P., Don Pritz. He's gone to the spirit world now, but I did not grab sobriety right away. And one night, this man came to me and he said, there's this guy talking up at Harmony House. He said, why don't we go up there and listen to him? And his name was Don P. So I went up there, and first thing I noticed was he had this big book, and it was beat and torn and coffee stained and rubber band and falling apart. You could tell that he probably really used that book a lot. And the other thing I noticed about him is he had the bluest eyes of anybody I've ever seen. His eyes were just blue, blue, blue. And he and I walked in that room, and he looked at me, and I looked at him. Something happened. There's this, our eyes met, and there was a feeling went across that we connected to one another, and it never, ever went away from the very, very first meeting. So he told a story, and then I related to it so strongly that I asked him if I could use that story, and he said yes. So this isn't my story. This is the story that I was given. And what the story is about is about this boxing match. And there was this arena, and in the black trunks over in the corner was alcohol, and the white trunks over in the opposite corner, that was me. And we're sitting there in that arena. People were coming in to the arena and are going to watch this fight that was going to take place. And like they do in those events is they always put a reserved ribbon in the front row, and that space is reserved for your family. So your family can see what's going on, and there's no one blocking the view. They got the best view in the house. So they came in and they let him sit down in the very first row. Then the referee came out and he said, okay, he said, when I tell you break and no hitting below the belt. He explained all these rules of mean alcohol. We were looking at one another in the eye, and there was something about looking at that alcohol in the eye that was attractive. I connected to it somehow. So anyway, we agreed to the rules and went back in the corner, and the bell rang. We came out, and the first couple of rounds was nothing. We were, you know, running around, boxing around, and it was really nothing. But somehow, about the third round, I think I moved the wrong way, and he moved the right way, and he just punched me really hard, and really stung me in the eye. And I was kind of surprised. And I looked at the alcohol, he looked at me, and he said, oh, you can whip me. He said, that was just a lucky punch. So it restored my confidence in what was going on. So as we continued that fighting, over the next couple of rounds, he was striking me more, it was hurting more, he was hitting below the belt, wasn't supposed to do that, the referee wasn't saying nothing. By the time the round 7-8 come, I was, my eyes were bloodied shut, and I was full of bruises, and so I come and I sit down in, at that bell. I sit down in a little chair, and I said, I got to get a strategy going here. I said, this alcohol is whipping my butt, so I got to do something. And I was trying to get a plan together on what I was going to do with this alcohol. And while I sat there, I felt this tug on my arm, and I looked down, and there was my son. And his dad, he said, Mom says to tell you, climb down, let's all go home. He said, you're getting beat up pretty bad, Daddy. He says, come on, let's just all go home. And I looked down at him and I said, I want you to tell your brothers and sisters to watch this next round. I said, because I got some old Indian tricks I'm going to use on this alcohol. I said, you just watch what I'm going to do. And so I got out there and the alcohol, it just put me down to my knees. I couldn't hardly stand up. It was kicking and punching me back in the head, doing everything illegal. And I couldn't wait for that bell to ring. I crawl back on my belly back to the chair, and I'm sitting there, and I'm trying to get the strategy together again. And I was getting desperate, and I knew I had to have a plan. And so I said, okay. And I'm really thinking of this plan, and I felt this tug on my arm again. And I looked down there, and it was my daughter, the little one. And she looked at me up with her beautiful little Indian eyes, and she said, Dad. I says, what? And she said, Mom says to tell you that we're going to go home. We're not going to stay here and watch it no more. We're going to leave. And she started to cry. She said, Dad, please come down. She said, please, come on, let's just go home. We'll just heal up. Come on. And I looked down at her and I said, I got one more thing I want to try. I said, you tell your brothers and sisters to sit there and watch. I said, I have this thing I want you to watch to see it. And so the bell rung and me and alcohol got out there, and it was no mercy anymore. He just put me right on my stomach and was kicking me and stomping me in the head. And I don't remember the moment my family left, but they did. They left. I crawled back to that, or back to my chair, and I looked at the alcohol. I said, alcohol is lying. I said, it really has beat me up. So I crawled out of that arena. I went home, and I got slept. In the morning, I got up, and I said, you're not in good shape. You better start exercising, and you better start eating some vegetables and fruit to get in shape. And so I went down to the bookstore, and I bought some self-help books, and I bought a candle, and I bought some flute music, and I thought, I just got to get it together again. So I spent the next 30 days, listening to music and exercising and eating lettuce. And what'd you know, I get thinking, I said, I think I know one trick that alcohol don't know about. And I said, I think I'm going to go back into the arena to see if the alcohol is even there. And so I went back to the arena, and sure enough, the alcohol was standing in that corner. His arms was on the ropes, and I shouted. I said, "Alcohol!" I said, "I am back." And the alcohol said, "I knew you would be." And so he said, "Come on up here." So I walked up to the arena, and as I was getting in the ropes, he didn't even let me get in the arena and get prepared. He just put the boots to me. As I was climbing through the ropes, they went right back down on the floor. Didn't take no 9 rounds. It happened instantly. And that's the way my drinking was. And so I walked back wounded, and I kept thinking, what the hell is going on? So I said, well, I think what happened is you went to the wrong bookstore. That's what happened. So would you know, I go to a different bookstore and get a different book and different candles and different flute music, and got sinking again. I bet you alcohol, and I went back in the, and this time alcohol wasn't in the arena. He was hiding inside the door to the building. And when I walked in there, just hit me from the back. The alcohol put me down right away. And so I said, I left there. And that was August 10th, 1978. It was 42 years ago. I left that building, and I never went back to alcohol. But instead, I come to you guys. I had heard about the AA. And I tried actively for 7 years to quit drinking. I tried all sorts of things, and I was raised by my grandpa with a real good bringing up and traditions and all that kind of things, me and grandpa. And I did everything my grandpa told me I wasn't supposed to do. Would I choose my bottle over my kids' food? That's what I did. Would I choose a bottle over the rent or the paying for this? I put thousands of dollars in debt. And so anyway, I said, I think I'm going to go to the AA. I heard about it. And so by then I was living in Colorado Springs. And so I went and I found a meeting place. And I didn't tell nobody I was going to go there. I just scoped it out. And so that night, 8 o'clock, a little bit before 8 o'clock, I drove down there where that meeting was. And in those days, they parked the car on a diagonal, not parallel, but diagonal. And so right in front of that door, there was a spot to park a car. And so I stopped in front of that spot, and I said, I'm going to go around the block one time. And if I come around that block, that spot's empty, that means I'm supposed to go in there. And so I went around the block, and I come back, and sure enough, that spot was empty. And I stopped, and I said, okay, just to make sure, I'm going to go around that block one more time. And if it's still empty when I come back, that's a sign I'm supposed to go in there. So I drove around that block just slow as I could go, it seemed like. And I got back around that in front of that place, and there it was. So I parked in there. And so I went up the stairs to that meeting, and I peeked in the door, and there was quite a few people in there, maybe 15 people was in that meeting. The thing that shocked me, though, is I said to myself, I says, oh, my God, this is all white people in here. I didn't see nothing but these white guys. And I thought, what in the heck are they going to teach me about quitting drinking or anything, you know? So I started to leave, and they had in that meeting what they call a greeter. And that was somebody who spotted newcomers, I guess. And anyway, it seemed like somehow he had like a shepherd's hook or something. He hooked me around the neck, and he slid me into that darn meeting, into that chair. And I had a cup of coffee in my hand, and there I'm sitting in this meeting with all these guys. So I said to myself, I said, I'm not telling them nothing. So when it comes to my time to speak, I didn't say anything. And so they didn't say anything, and they finished the meeting. And there were 3 things about that meeting that bothered me. One was they were telling on themselves. They were telling about being selfish and dishonest and crooked and all this stuff. And I thought, God, what's the matter with them? Why would you be telling about yourself? Where I come from, you never did tell about yourself. Then the other thing that irritated me a lot was they were always laughing, not like he. I mean, they was belly laughing, just deep getting it on, you know, and it just irritated me because there was nothing funny about nothing. And then the third thing that bothered me was there was a feeling there. I never had that feeling before. There was just something. I couldn't even explain it. I just, you know, it kind of made me get shivers sometimes sitting in there. And I didn't know for about a year what that feeling was, but after I was around it for a while, I found out that's that feeling you get when you come home. That's that feeling you show up on where you belong. That's that feeling you get when you show up where people love you and they understand you. But I didn't know that because I had not ever been around that, you know. I was raised in a very abusive home. My dad was, when he was drinking, he was terrible. And so I watched my mom get beat up. All kinds of stuff went on. And so I didn't really have this feeling of belonging. That's not how it seemed. But then I figured that out after about a year being in the program. So anyway, I went to long enough and I found out that I needed to get a sponsor. I didn't talk, but I was just listening to what people said. And
straw holder thingy.
Sure. Revolutionary.
I bought that book, big book, and because they told me there was instructions in it, and I looked all over in that dang book, and I couldn't find no instructions anywhere. And so I felt really lost. So I decided I would look for this sponsor to see. And so I watched and I saw this older guy, and he was very tall, like 6'5", 6'6", something. He's a big guy. And he was sober 15 years, 16 years. And he must have fought a lot because his face was all full of scars. His head had scars and stuff in it. And I think that I think he was hit with an ugly stick when he was a baby. That sponsor, that first one, he wasn't pretty at all. He was just a guy. But anyway, I talked to him about being a sponsor. And so he said, we'll talk about it. And so we chatted some. And there were times he seemed to irritate me because he was saying things that I wish he wouldn't have said, but he did. But one of the things he told me is he said, he grabbed this book, AA, and then he held a part in his hands how much 164 pages were. And he looked at me and he said, if you are willing to do exactly what's in those 164 pages, he said, you will never have to drink again. He said, AA is not about slipping. He said, it's a program that was given to us about never drinking again, but staying sober no matter what happens. He said, you have the ability to stay sober. But he said, in that book, there's questions, you got to answer them. I can't remember, I think he said there were 57 musts or something, M-U-S-T. And so he said, when it says a must, that's not an option. And that means that's what you got to do. And so he decided that he'd be my sponsor. So then he took a meeting schedule and he circled 6 meetings. I had to go to a meeting every night for 6 nights. And he circled like a big book study group. There was a step meeting. There was one meeting where all the real old guys were going. In that meeting, they had their own chair and you could not sit anywhere you wanted to because Fred sat in this chair or Bill sat in this chair, you know. So the young guys, we had to go sit on a bench. So I had to go to these meetings and he said, you go to these meetings and you say your name is Don, you say you're an alcoholic, and then he said, you shut up. He said, until you take a third step, you have nothing of any value to anybody to help, nobody in no way, don't share, he said, just be quiet. And so, you know, AA is kind of small community, so when they saw me not sharing in the meeting, they go, oh, I knew who your sponsor is, you know, that's Big Frank, you know. And so, anyway, he took me through the work. And so, he showed me the first 44 pages had to do the first half of step one, and then page 52, there was a paragraph there he called the unmanageability paragraph, and there were nine areas of personal relationships, emotional nature I had to look at. And that was how I looked at the instructions for the second half of step one. Then one of the things he used to talk sometimes, and it took me maybe 3, 4, 6 months or a year to understand, because he would say the steps are all interconnected with each other. They're not separate. But I'd look at them and I'd say, well, they got numbers, they're separate. But he said, no, he said, the work you do in step one is connected to the work you do in step two. Step two has to get the information that you have in step one. And so he would show me then to how to take those nine areas from unmanageability. And then I had to make nine little mini visions in step two. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could make my relationships better, improve my emotional nature, help me not be afraid of fear, you know, et cetera. And then he told me, he said, step two, set your intent for step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, he said, you set it up in step two. Then he said, there's two more parts that will come for the vision. One will be in the fear inventory, what would God have me be instead? And then in the sex inventory, what should I have done instead? He said, that will be added to this vision, you know, in step two. And so that was the way that he was. He was very methodical and very, he said, every sentence in the big book is an instruction. And boy, he was just really tough to work with for quite a while. And then I had some struggle going on with step three, because I attended one of the church boarding schools, and you know, those nuns, they can be pretty tough on things that they can do. I think we had the meanest darn nuns that the church ever put, you know, back on our reservation. And so I had a funny concept of God, and then here you guys are saying, oh, by the way, you got to turn your life to your will over the care of God. And I went, oh no. But whoever's wisdom it was that said God as you understand him, that was powerful. That was just whoever got that wise thing to add, that was very, very powerful. So then he showed me how to write the inventory, and I got into inventory, and he showed me how to write a 5-column resentment inventory, 4-column fear inventory, and 11-column sex inventory. And I was told, you have to tell everything. You got to write everything that's in there. You call it the dark crannies, you know, by the big book. And so I remember one night I was sitting there, and what came up for me was something I never, ever told anybody, drunk or sober, and that was my sexual abuse. When I was 9 years old, I was sexually abused by an uncle for 3 years. And I was so scared. When I see him coming down the road, I'd run, jump in bed, make believe I was sick. I'd get under the covers and I'd cough, and my mother would say, you lazy thing, you get out there and help him chop that wood. But I knew what was going to happen, I knew what was going on there. And they do that in such a way you don't tell. You just keep that a secret, you know. And your little guy, you know what, something's not right. Then, I think it was close to 3 years, there was a big beer party on our reservation, and a fight broke out. And somebody had a gun, and they shot him 6 times in the heart, in the chest. And I remember that next morning, we heard about that murder, and here it was him. I was so happy. But that was my mother's most favorite brother. And she was just cried for days, you know. And I always felt really bad that I was feeling good about something that hurt my mother so strongly there. And so I had a very difficult time for a while writing inventory. The stuff that I was writing, I'd done so much crappy stuff, you know. I hurt my kids and my spouse and stole money, and I cheated, and you know, every darn thing that you can do. And I was feeling really, really down about that darn inventory. And I was talking to Frank one day, and he said, this inventory, he said, you're thinking you're writing the truth about you. And I said, well, yeah, I'm writing the truth about me. And he said, no, he said, you're writing the truth about the lie. He said, that third column stuff that's in there, he said, that's not the truth. He said, that's where the lie is. He said, that's what's behind the alcohol. Alcohol is a symptom. You got to get down to the causes. And he said, that's the column. He said, you think because your dad told you you was no good that you said, that's the truth, you're no good. He said, that's the lie. But you're believing something that's not true. And all of a sudden, just something shifted enough that I could continue writing the inventory, and I could go on and write about the fear inventory, and I could go on and write about the sex inventory. And I had to write each column separate, the dishonesty, the selfishness, the jealousy, and all that. I had to write that separate because he said it's easier to see the patterns then. And so I went ahead and I did that, and then I fifth stepped it. And at first I had about six pages I had in my pocket, because I wasn't so sure I was going to tell anybody that stuff. Because I could go to jail, I could be in trouble with the law, you know. And so anyway, through that first step, that guy I first stepped with, he had an inkling I was hiding something. So he told me some stuff about his inventory, his first one, and I thought, boy, that mother is sick. I said, he's worse than me. So then him sharing that, I said, oh, yeah, I got a little bit more. And so I got those pages out of my pocket, and then I told the whole story. So then he showed me how to go home. I had to review. Then I had to claim the fifth step promises. And he said, every odd set of steps has a promise. But to every promise in the big book, it's got a condition. So it's like withholding nothing, then you get the promise. If you withhold something, you don't get the promise. Everyone has some kind of a condition to it. And so that's why I had to do that review, and I did that. So I went ahead and I did my step six and seven, and I made amends. I had a lot of amends to make, and he was very insistent that I make my amends in person. And so I had to write them out, because the first couple of amends I made, when that person said something, I changed the amend. I changed what I was originally going to say, and then that came up with my sponsor. So he said, you got to write it out, and I want to know that you read this amend to him. You didn't leave something out. So I went ahead and I made his amends. So I always called him my head sponsor, because he was very strict by the big book. So the next time I went through the work, I went through Don Pritz, and I called him my heart sponsor. So his trip through the big book was way different than when Frank took me through it. His was more of the hard stuff. And then the third time I went through the work, I had run into this elder Indian man. His name was Johnny Looking Cloud. And when I was about three and a half years sober around there, I went crazy. Meetings got stupid. My sponsor got stupid. I couldn't underline anymore in that big book. It was all underlined, seemed like, you know. And I was very judgmental at sitting in the meetings, because these guys would say the same old story every dang time about I could tell their story better than them, you know. And I judged and I did all that stuff. And so I started to get this feeling I was going to drink again. That's how it seemed. By then I had started to repair my family, and there was a lot of things that were going on with the family and finances and money, you know, things was kind of straightening out. And so I felt I was losing it. So I went to see Johnny Looking Cloud, and we used to sit in his backyard, and he took a stick and he drew a circle in the dirt. And he said, we were watching you when you come into AA. As he said, most of us thought you wouldn't make it. He said, we was watching you. You were so angry and so just miserable and so hateful. As he said, we thought, you know, you would leave meetings and you wouldn't talk, and you could see it in your face. He said, we didn't think you was going to make it, but he said you did. And so he said, so now, as he said, it's time, he said, that you add the culture to your AA program. And I said, you know, you can't really do that. I said, that's a white man's program. You have to do it like that. He said, no, no, no. He said, this isn't a white man's program. And he said, this is what you got to understand. He said, all those things your grandpa taught you, you got to come back to those ways. He said, your culture, your community, they taught you about the earth and about the plants and about the medicine and about circles and about cycles and nature. And that's what you got to come back to. And so he said, you need to realize everything travels in a circle or a cycle. And he said, all the tree, it goes four seasons, spring, summer, fall, winter, and then it gets its leaves again. And so he gave a number of examples, and he said, in recovery, as he said, your season is 4 years. As he said, you will have your first year is like a spring, the second year is like a summer, the third year is like a fall, the fourth year is like a winter. And he said, when you come into AA, it's like an oak tree in the spring. It comes standing out there and nothing's going on. It looks dead. And he said, but then the sap starts to flow in that tree. The life force starts to flow in that tree. But the tree don't know it yet. It hasn't done nothing. All that happens is the life force starts to flow. And he said, that's what happened to you when you come into the AA. He said, the creator started to work inside of you, but you didn't know it yet. Then he said, all of a sudden one day, the oak tree starts to get little buds on all of its leaves around here and there. This little life force starts to flow up. And he said, you go through that 12 steps that first year, then that's what you come out with. You got all these little buddings. You got these hopes and dreams and possibilities, and you talk yourself in and out of it, and you know, all that kind of stuff. Then he said, you come into the second year and those buds unfold. All those buds on that tree, now that tree has got like a shape. And he said, that's what happens in your second year. You go to meetings, you go through the work again, and all of a sudden you start to get an identity. You start to see that something's going on. Then he said, you think it's going to be that way, and the season changes again. You come into the third year, and he said, all of a sudden, it's just like the oak tree. It's fruits and harvest and red and yellow, and people are taking this picture, and it's just, they think it has arrived. It thinks, it don't get any better than this. I want to stay like this fall forever. And he said, and that's the way your third year of sobriety is, as he said. So you'll think, okay, I have arrived. I'm going to be like this forever. Everything's going to just fall in line. And it's not that you don't get flat tires, you still do, but you get that flat tire right in front of a gas station. You go, all right, not out in the desert, you know. And so then you think everything's together, just like the oak tree, and then all of a sudden winter comes, starts to come along. And at first, the oak tree loses a few leaves, and the oak tree says, ah, it's no big deal, I got a lot of leaves. Then a little temperature change, a little time goes by, and then all of a sudden the wind starts to change and blows out a fourth of the leaves away. Now the oak tree is saying, okay, this is not quite right here. It's like a little flag. I know I gotta go to more meetings. I'm gonna double up on my meetings, and I'm gonna read that big book a little bit more, and maybe I'll hang out with my sponsor, you know. And then you do that stuff, and then all of a sudden temperature changes a little bit, gust of wind comes along, now about half the leaves go away. And you're doing all those things. You're going to meetings, reading the book, working with your sponsor. And you're going, what in the hell is going on? Just like that oak tree. It's wondering what in the hell is going on. And then all of a sudden, it happens. All the leaves blow away. And then that's where I was in those meetings. All of a sudden, the meetings weren't working. Sponsors were, I had no leaves. All the stuff that I was going to do, you see, wasn't working. And so what I saw when I went to see Johnny Claude is I thought I was doing something wrong. I thought, I'm doing everything I told, but my life can't be turned to crap like this if I'm doing, I must be missing something. That's what I thought. I was doing something wrong. Then I started to try to gather what I thought I was doing wrong. I said, well, you know, what happens is you say God and shit in the same sentence, and that's how come your life's turning to crap. You can't be saying God and shit in the same sentence, you know. And so that's what I thought was going on. And Johnny Claude, he said, no, he said, God's not mad. He said, you're not doing nothing wrong. He said, you're just in winter. He said, that's the way it is. Those leaves are all those things that you learn in your first 3 years. Now that's called clarity. So now you got to shift. those things gotta go away. So, I mean, doesn't it make sense that oak trees gotta lose its leaves so it can become the new shape, the new oak tree for the next year? And he said that's what's going. But he said, in the winter time, he said, the reason you feel lost is there's three questions you can't answer. One question you lose the answer to is, why am I? He said, you lose your purpose. The second question that you can't answer is, who am I? You lose your identity. And the third question you can't answer is, where am I going? So he said, you'll go to meetings and you'll be trying to say something cool in the meetings and you'll go, I don't even know who I am. I don't know what the hell happened, you know? So even your relationship, you know, like the person you're with will sense that something's wrong. So then he said, it's not only you, but he said, if you're with somebody, a partner, then they're going to have spring, summer, fall, winter. So you could be in summer and they could be in winter. Then he said, in your relationship, it will take on seasons, marriage or dating or living together, whatever it is, your relationships will go spring, summer, fall, winter. And so we got, what I was able to start to see is, I could start to see my kids was going through a cycle system. People I worked with was going through a spring, summer, fall, winter. And I started to watch what that meant. Like, I don't know if you've ever been like in a fall season, or maybe somebody you're carpooling with, maybe they're in fall season and like you're in a winter season. Well, winter season people, when they get in a car in the morning, they just clear two little spots in the ice in the windshield. You don't clean the whole windshield, just two little spots, you know. And then you drive down the road and you stop to pick up this person who's in the fall season, and they're like big happy people. They're just like joyful, and they hop in that car with this big smile, you know. And, oh my God, did you see the icicles this morning? The beauty of God just bouncing off the icicles. And you look at them and say, will you shut up? You know, you're in a different place. So I started to learn that this is what happened. So he said, it'll happen again in years 7 to 8, happen again 3 to 4, I mean, 11 to 12, it'll happen again 15 to 16. And so in my recovery, I learned I participate in a cycle system. So when I started to bring the cultural knowledge back, then all of a sudden it seemed like I really, really, really belonged. And here I was having these 12 principles that I could put in a circle, that I could put in the four directions. And then I learned later on how to use the medicines, you know, and things with them. And so I made a vow after my fourth year. I said, this AA, I said, this is going to be my way of life. If somebody gives me a fancy book that tells me there's 7 steps to happiness, if I can't reconcile in those 12 steps, I ain't doing it. Because whether I drink or, this isn't like, whether I get a rash or something, you know, I'm an alcoholic. That guy's waiting in that ring for me to come back in there. You know, he don't age or nothing. He just hangs out to see who's going to come back and do the fight. And so I've learned I don't want to go back there no more. I don't want to go to a bookstore. I don't want to burn that stuff because you guys have taught me, you know, what it is I'm to do. You know, we alcoholics are undisciplined, you know, as the book says, well, that's really true. And so sometimes I think that, I remember one time I went to Alaska and I was taught these kids, they had a leadership training for 3 days with these kids. And I remember I worked with them the first day in Alaska. They have 2 clans. They have the Eagle Clan and the Raven Clan, and they have sub clans, but I remember at the end of the day, we were getting ready to quit, and one of the young guys, he said, all the eagles stand up. And so they stood up, and he told a summary of what I said that day. And then they sat down, and then one of the young girls said, all the ravens stand up. They stood up, and she did a recap of what she heard that day. And I had never experienced that before. So that night I was having lunch, dinner with a sponsor of that, of those kids. And I said, why do those kids do that? I said, that wasn't on the agenda or nothing. And she said, well, just come from their village teachings. They said what they wanted to know, they were taught this. They wanted to know at the end of the day, they wanted you to know that your words didn't fall to the ground, that they was listening. And so how they show you that is they tell you what you said. So sometimes when I give these talks to the AA, that's how I feel. I don't tell you nothing new. I'm just telling you back what you guys taught me. And there's meetings, you know, and I like to share back because I like you to know I was listening. I your words, you know, didn't fall to the ground. And so that's what happened. And what it was like and what it's like now is I attended a gratitude meeting one time, and I come out of there, and I was 4 years sober, and I sat under this big tree, and I was chatting with the Creator. That's how I do it sometimes. I don't like have this big fold my hands praising. I just chit-chat with the Creator, and I said, you know, I said, I'm 4 years sober. Really? I said, you both know I ain't cheated. I ain't smell none. I didn't sip none. I said, I'm really, 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 I ain't smoke no dope. I ain't do no pot, nothing. I said, you know that I'm really, really, really sober. And so I said to the Creator, I said, you know, I know there's a place in the big book where it says you're not supposed to pray for yourself. I said, I know where that is in there. So I said, but I said, I got this idea. I said, if you would allow me, I would like to carry this message of recovery to my people. That's what I would like to do. I said, this, I'm really sober in this, and it's not a white man's program. I'm doing the culture the way that I was told. I said, is there any way you would allow me to carry this message out to the tribes, out to the people? I said, if you do, I said, I'll spend the rest of my life doing it. I said, I'll do whatever, you know, I need to do. And so things changed in my life. Things shifted, and all of a sudden I was able to start working with the tribes. So the first 15 years, I started a nonprofit called White Bison that come out of a vision that I was given. And the first 15 years, I traveled 100,000 miles a year for 15 years going to the tribes, carrying the message, helped to start groups. I tried to never say no. If they asked me, no matter where it was, I tried to go because I really quit drinking. This program really, really, really works, you know. And then I remember, I know it was 4 or 5 years ago, I had a chance to speak at an Al-Anon conference in outside of Santa Fe. And I began to see what was missing in our communities was Al-Anon. There was something was missing. And because when I go to Al-Anon, they know things AAs don't. And so I happened to mention about there wasn't a lot of Al-Anon meetings in AA that I knew about. Just hadn't outreached there yet. And so I happened to kind of mention in that talk, I said, wouldn't it be nice if we could get the Al-Anon into our native communities? And Norm and Juanita and some of the others, it wasn't a matter of time. They put together this group of wonderful people, and they ended up with planners and secretaries and helpers and conference people, and they put together this first Native American Al-Anon group. And I will go there sometimes. I have to walk away and just cry because it was like so needed. And you start to see it happen. It was going on. And so I would guess there's probably about 30 Al-Anon meetings started out of that conference at different places, and they they would struggle, you know, they wouldn't know what they're supposed to do and what kind of literature to call. And but anyway, it got going. And so they made a commitment, you know, for 4 years, like spring, summer, fall, winter. They took it through the seasons and then took that seed. Now it's in Portland, Oregon. So now they got a spring, summer, fall, winter. My guess is it's going to go, you know, somewhere else. And there was so much support from the world people with Claire and some of those that was helping us get this thing going. And it was a little bit strange at the very first one because we bought a hoop and we had sage burning and we had cedar going and people were praying in languages, and not all of them there was used to that, that kind of cultural going on. But by the end of the weekend, they were dancing and singing with a drum and, you know, everything else right along with us, you know. So then it happened the next year, and there would be 200 people show up that they come from Canada, and they people were planning that darn conference. They just loved the Al-Anon conference. It was so powerful in the speakers. And you heard Navajo ladies talk about 15 years in Al-Anon, and you'd hear these men, we didn't even know they existed. And they were actually in Al-Anon talking about, and when the others saw that there were Native men in Al-Anon, they stepped forward, like coming out of the closet or whatever it says when you expose yourself, you know. So this movement is taking place, and then we run into you, Yvonne, and you're taking the dang Al-Anon going all over the whole darn world, you know, sharing what's going on. And you know, I was in our first conversations, I was telling somebody about you, and I said that girl is like a positive mafia. I said you just don't tell her no. She says she wants something, you better just say yes and go do it, because she ain't taking no for an answer. But she was just your energy, and I thank you for putting this together and for doing that work. You know, it's just wonderful what you're doing. Allowing, I think it's allowing the Al-Anon conference to let the world see what you guys, your words didn't fall to the ground. At those gatherings that you put together, it's spreading, you know, and it's working, you know, and it's going. And now the seed is out in Portland, and I talked to the area a person that's planning that, and the COVID is not quite there. I can send you, they have a flyer. I'll send that flyer to you. That maybe you can post it. But they do have a plan for the next conference, you know, out there in the early next spring. So I'll send you that conference. Maybe we can post it. So with that, I just want to close with this prayer. It seems like everything that I've learned in this recovery, I learned from you guys, you know. And, I know that when I first got into recovery, I had no intentions of getting sober. I was beyond that. But I know my family was praying for me. I believe I had intervention from God. God said, this fool Indian ain't going to make it. I'm going to have to help. And so I was given that help. But the one that really helped me was a lot was, I remember the weekend, I was married then. I remember that weekend that my wife caught on to what Al-Anon was about. My darn life changed like you just can't believe. And she caught on what she was supposed to do with me, not do with me. This scared the heck out of me because her behavior changed so much, and she wouldn't cover for me, and a whole bunch of stuff, you know, was going on. So, you know, Al-Anon saved my life. I just, and with my children, so I'm forever grateful. So I'll close with this prayer. And it says, God, thank you for what you've given me. God, thank you for what you've taken from me. And God, thank you for what you left me. And I sit here and I can look at Zoom, and this is what's left. You know, just beautiful people all over the world coming together to spend a couple of days sharing recovery. So with that, I'll just close and say thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Don. Am I? Yeah. Can anybody unmute themselves and give him a hand so we can hear you all out here?
Thank you, guys.
So if you want to express some gratitude or ask a question, stick your blue hand in the air or chat with me and I will unmute you. If you would like to share a little bit, you guys. Michelle, can you unmute yourself?
I did. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. Don, thank you so much for your words. I'm native from Canada. I'm Anishinaabe, Chumigwach. I am Al-Anon, and I have found so much hope and help through the Al-Anon program. I'm new, though, and I was wondering if you could take a few minutes, if you are comfortable, and explain, because you mentioned briefly your experience with the reserve nuns and the non-native religions, and how you can, like, you mentioned the creator. I'm trying to connect, but could you speak a little bit more about that for your own experience, please?
When I first got into, maybe it's very short, but when I first got into writing inventory, I would write what happened to our tribe when it got moved from New York to Wisconsin 5 times. And I would have their name in the first column, what they did, and I would go through that. And the person I would first step with, they'd say, "Why the hell are you doing that? Then was then, now is now. You weren't there. I mean, why are you writing this stuff down? Get honest." And so I didn't know. Then later on, thanks to some of our own Native researchers, I found out what happened with the intergenerational trauma, what happened with the boarding schools. And then I learned in Canada, at a meeting that I went to first, is a scientist in Canada proved scientifically that trauma is recorded in a layer of the DNA. And so you cannot have gone to the boarding school if your grandparents did. Then you can carry that hurt and the anger, but you don't know why you're angry. We didn't know any of that. So then some of us, we started to find out that when we worked the 12 steps, we had to look at the unmanageability of what we were carrying around of our grandpa and grandma's hurt inside. We had to learn how do I heal that? And when we started to do that, things shifted a lot. So many never drank again. When we started to realize we had to heal from the intergenerational trauma, and it's very difficult to talk about that because it didn't happen to the white people didn't have intergenerational trauma. They didn't have that boarding school. But the murdering and the kids and the sexual abuse and all that stuff went on, that really helped a lot in the recovery when we figured out in the 12 steps, how do you inventory and process all the way through the forgiveness, steps 8 and 9 with the intergenerational trauma, if that makes sense.
Thank you.
Okay.
Michael.
Hey, Don, thanks a lot. Really good to hear you. I'm out in California.
Hi, Michael. I talked
to you yesterday. It's good to see you again. I've been sober for 35 years, but I've been in Al-Anon for 38 because I was brought through the program, through Alateen, and then I was brought in, and eventually I became a member of AA. And I get to some Al-Anon meetings, and it seems there's like an edge towards alcoholics who want to try to find the Al-Anon way of life and the message, because there's some unresolved issue towards the alcoholic. But I'm a double winner, as they say. I need to have both of these. I'm very active in both programs, and I encourage alcoholics to come to Al-Anon because there's so much in the family afterward, in the message. whether it's the family afterward or two wives or the employer. I mean, they're all families that we have out there. So it does kind of predicate on that forgiveness. But I also try to tell the Al-Anons, you got to let us come here too. You got to let us be here with you. Some level. Not that you need to carry us here, just that the doors open, that we can come here. Because I think you are right. The message is different in the Al-Anon program than it can be in the AA program. Mm-hmm. And so I just encourage you to be open. If you want it, I've seen my life change from that. You know, if some of these family members would just get better, I'd get better. That doesn't work that way. I have to have my own spiritual awakening with this work in Al-Anon also. And so there's an educational part, but there's also, I must take the work on and face up to how I find this power for myself. And it's not through the substance. It's through how I solve problems. Because I get a little codependent. I get a little worried. I start getting into, well, is everybody happy? Is everybody going to do it my way? You know, and I get a lot of information, but I don't get a lot of transformation. And so it's been really important that I came up through a lady who, she was they call it a black belt Al-Anon. I had a sponsor who was married to him. That was my AA sponsor, but I ended up getting pseudo-sponsored by her, and she would take all her people that were in Al-Anon through the big book, through the AA book. And there's a thought sometimes in Al-Anon, oh no, we don't do that. That has nothing to do with Al-Anon. And that's not the groups I came from. I have been around these hardcore Al-Anons that use the big book to look at how that was for them. And they use that. And of course, Al-Anon's developed over the years tremendous literature and things. But they had them go, she would take people through the big book, and I had got to witness that, and she ended up becoming, she didn't know it for years, but she sponsored me through her husband with the Al-Anon part of it as well. Yeah. I wanted to ask you, Don, if you could talk a little bit about how you say forgiveness, but how would you describe forgiveness to us? How would you internally... How do you come to terms mentally, emotionally, spiritually, and have that be something that really, what's the journey for you that shows us how your forgiveness is effective for you?
The elders gave us a teaching around forgiveness, four directions. So in the East is the forgiveness where you bump into somebody, you say, oh, I'm sorry, you know, forgive me. Then in the South, there's another type of forgiveness, which is more difficult than the first one. And that one is called forgiving the unforgivable. And so that could be like assault or, you know, those sexual abuse or those types of issues. Then there's one in the West is harder than that one, and that is the forgiveness of self. You know, sometimes, I don't know if you've ever done something just so stupid, irreversible, it won't change. And you're just, you know, so that's harder sometimes than forgiving the unforgivable. And then in the North is a type of forgiveness that the other person has wounded you so bad that you forgive them because to set their spirit free, they couldn't do it. That's a really hard one to do. Takes a lot of power, you know, to do that, to actually go to them. They really wronged you. You logically don't have to do it, and you go there with the intent of setting that person's spirit free. You know, that's just four types of forgiveness. So when I go into eight step and look at my willing to make the amends, I try to see which one of those am I dealing with. It kind of helps me pinpoint, and sometimes it's both. Sometimes it's forgiving the unforgivable and forgiving myself, you know, in doing that. So that's how I look at the forgiveness, and how do you apply that through the 12 steps, you know, is that then I know there's one type of forgiveness that you cannot do. And Johnny Looking Cloud is the one that showed me this, is he was a staunch Catholic, and he was a staunch traditional guy. And so he didn't see it as two ways. The way he grew, his Catholic faith was the same as his Indian faith, so he could hold a big book in one hand and an eagle feather in the other and not blink an eye. He just was very unique. And one of the things that he told me is he said there's when you cannot forgive, he said, there's three things. He said, one is two of them you can do, one you cannot do. And so the way he was, he wouldn't tell me the whole story. He's, you know, one at a time, while those old guys are. So one of them, I had to admit that the forgiveness, where it had to take place, was inside of me. And then it took me a while. I said, yeah, but you don't understand it. No. So I finally, took me a month or so, and I said, okay, I got that. Then he said, the second one that you can do is, he says, you wrote the story about that forgiveness. You're the author. How you went through it, your self-talk described the story of what went on there. And he said, you might have added some too. He said, you might have made it a little bit more dramatic and stuff like that. So he said, that's the two you can do. One is, you got to admit it's inside of you. And the second, you're the author. But I said, yeah, but you don't understand. But I understood. I was describing that event that had to happen. Then he said, a third thing you cannot do. And so he said, I don't understand to this day, but I only did it. But he said, light your sage, your medicine, you know, and smudge yourself and do that. But he said, there's only one person can do the third one. And he said, you got to say these words exactly. Holy Spirit. He said, you can't say Tankashla, God, whatever you're, you got to use these words, because it calls a special person to ask that Holy Spirit to give you a new story. He said, you cannot use your logic and rationalization to get it. But the certain ones, you got to have, the Holy Spirit's got to come and give you the story. And that's what I did with my uncle. I that affected my relationships, marriages, all work, all that stuff. It was very, I didn't want to forgive him. I wanted the Creator to bring him back to life, give me 10 minutes with a son of a bitch, and then I'll forgive him. You know? I mean, son of a gun. So anyway, that would be the short version, is that there's certain forgivenesses, you have to have help with it. And what, how he explained to me, you have to say, Holy Spirit, to give me a new story. And I did that almost 23 times. In my forgiveness journey, that I could not, I had the events, the resentment was so deep that I had to have the Holy Spirit do it for me. I couldn't do it, but I got to do the first two first. You don't get the third.
Thank you, Don. Cassidy, can you unmute Joanne for a minute? And Joanne, do you guys have a date for the next Native American Al-Anon conference?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, we do. First off, I'm Joanne, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. Oregon is very excited to have the next Native American Al-Anon conference, April 30th, May 1st, and May 2nd. Plan A is, we already have the Sheraton at the Portland Airport reserved. Plan B, we're coming up with right now.
All right. If we can help you with anything, Joanne, let us know. Thank you so much for being here.